I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Well, there's a mother in Tulia, Texas, who is forever indebted to a newspaperman. Her four children were all arrested, accused of selling drugs. Three of them were convicted, and all on the say-so of one rotten cop. It was due to the persistence of writers like Bob Herbert, columnist for the New York Times, that these people were eventually set free. Even today, there are soldiers injured in the Iraq War whose stories might not be told if it weren't for writers like Bob Herbert. His work is a reminder of the old credo of newspapers, that they are supposed to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. However, it's a role that frequently pits him against elected politicians and others. Bob is here today, and we invite you to join our conversation. How do you see the role of the columnist? Is this person meant to be an advocate or an explainer, a voice of outrage? All of the above or none of the above? And what do you think of Bob Herbert's perspective? Do you appreciate his defense of the little guy, or does that get too political, too partisan? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bob is here with me in the studio. He has a collection of his columns in a brand new book. The title is Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. It's nice to finally see you face to face. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to be here, Dick. Thank you.
So whose promise is being betrayed here?
Well, I think some of the great promises that really stand for the American Dream are being betrayed. I tell everybody that, you know, when I was growing up in suburban New Jersey in the 1950s and 60s, it wasn't a better time than now. But I had the feeling that you were moving in a better direction in those days. It was kind of easy to get a job with good pay and good benefits. It was becoming easier for kids of modest means to get a college education. There were movements in the air. The civil rights movement was going on. Soon the women's movement would come, the environmental movement, that sort of thing. So even when you'd read in the paper about the various injustices that were always out there, you had a sense that those just injustices would get taken care of, that we were moving to a better place. And I think that now that's not so much the case. Now I get a sense of us maybe, you know, sliding backwards or reversing direction.
When you say we, are you saying that the betrayal is a betrayal of the leaders of the country, or do your readers, do all citizens bear some responsibility for that at the same time?
It's hard to define it very clearly, but I am a strong believer in leadership, and I think leadership can take you politically, for example, to the right or to the left, so you can get leadership that would follow Lyndon Johnson in the mid-1960s, and you can get leadership that would follow Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. Those are two pretty different political directions. So I always think that leadership is really important. And the leadership that we've had over the past, well, it's been quite a while now. I mean, the better part of two decades probably, has sort of pressed this idea that you're on your own, that greed is good, that success for success's sake is, you know, what we're really after. And much of the media and the public has bought into that. And that doesn't leave a lot of room or a lot of resources for the kind of collective action that, for example, would lead to wider opportunities or the widest possible opportunities. So now you see us falling backwards in things like health care, eroding Social Security. Under Bill Clinton, you know, you took the steps backward on welfare and called it reform, that sort of thing. So it's kind of a betrayal, I think, over a sort of a wide horizon.
I notice when I go through your book that the columns that you have written focus on the ordinary working person, the person who gets skewered by the justice system, ordinary people who find themselves up against either a bureaucracy or a leadership or some force that they can't push against. In the last, what is it? You tell me, couple of months now, you've really turned your attention to the Iraq War. Is this something that you resisted? Have you changed your mind? Why that shift?
Well, for one thing, if you're going to have a war, it seems to me, if you're going to be involved in a war, that ought to be the biggest story in front of you, on every day. It's kind of amazing to me that you can turn on television while we're at war, you know, and Michael Jackson and Martha Stewart are bigger stories than what's going on in Iraq. You know, anybody who read the column knew that I was opposed to the war going in, but if you're going to fight a war, then you need to win the war. And I think that this war has been just so mishandled from the very beginning that it's tragic. And the other thing is, we hear all the pretty words about you have to support the troops and that sort of thing. Well, I frankly believe that you have to support the troops. And I think that as a country and as a government, we have not done that. 70% of the casualties in Iraq have come from these roadside bombs. And yet, as I wrote in a column today, we've had a miserable record in providing the kind of protective armor that's needed for Humvees and other vehicles over there. There's no collective sense of responsibility for fighting this war. So the troops who are fighting are coming from a very narrow slice of the population, and that's the slice down near the bottom. These are the kids who are not particularly well-educated compared to the population as a whole, whose families do not have a lot of money.
Let's take that one example. Would you change that by going back to a national draft?
Well, here's where even my liberal friends get a little upset. Sure, I've always been in favor of a draft. I think that you should have mandatory service for all Americans, a couple of years of service. And you can do a lot of things. You could be in the military. You could help the homeless. You could provide literacy services and that sort of thing. But I think everybody, to show that this is a collective effort, the United States of America, should give up a couple of years. And if you're going to fight wars, then sure, I think that you should have a draft and you should draw the people who are going to defend the country from the widest swath of the population that you possibly can. This idea that, you know, we can afford to have the underprivileged, so to speak, fight our wars is an obscene idea to me.
Is it your view that you know, put this decision in the minds of congressional representatives and senators whose own children then might have to fight the war would have them thinking a little bit more slowly or a little bit more carefully about that commitment?
That would be a big part of it, but an even bigger part of that would be the population as a whole. I mean, if you have voters from coast to coast seeing that their sons and daughters might have to go over to fight in the war in Iraq, then you might have a different perspective, and the Congress would respond to that. I mean, you would have a different perspective. I mean, many of my friends have young children, not even old enough to fight wars yet, but there is no sense at all that their kids, these are families who are pretty well-to-do, sense at all that their kids might have to go off to the military and fight a war in a few years.
Do you make a connection in your own mind between what goes on overseas, the criticism that you have, the very sharp-pointed criticism you have about the way that the Iraq war is being led, and what's going on here in the country when you have so many people who are looking for work, people having a hard time finding health care? Do these connect for you?
The idea of our foreign policy and the domestic issues that are going on here at home?
I mean, if we look at it all as betrayed promises of the American dream, do they fit together under that?
I think they do fit together, and they fit together in my mind in the sense that there's no sense of shared responsibility and no sense of shared sacrifice. So if we're going to fight our wars, then a small segment of the population can fight our wars. And if we're going to use our tax dollars for whatever, the trend recently has been to keep taxes as low as possible, shift the benefits to the wealthy, and begin to cut the services that go to the population as a whole. And that started initially with the idea of cutting services for the poor, which is, you know, easier to do politically. But I knew even then, you know, that you would start inching up. And then after a while, they'd be going after things like Medicare. They'd be going after things like Social Security. But they're also, we don't finance our public school systems properly.
But when we have columnists like you who spend time on the street doing reporting, making those ordinary people a part of the opinions that you're writing, I mean, when I listen to you talk, I'm thinking to myself, maybe that's a bad thing. Maybe we should all be as concerned about the people you're writing about. I began the program by talking about Tulia, Texas, and the 40-some-odd people who were all thrown in jail on the say-so of this rotten cop. How many columns did you write about that?
I ended up writing about a dozen columns. I mean, I've never done that before.
And all those people are out of jail now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. I mean, this was an outrageous situation. I mean, very briefly, what happened was you had a federally financed drug investigation in Tulia, Texas, and the investigation consisted essentially of one cop who went into what he called an undercover mode, and he went around rounding up people just from the black section of Tulia, Texas. Excuse me. And so 40-some people were arrested. Most of them were black. A handful were whites who had relationships with blacks. It turned out that he had said initially that these were major drug dealers. I mean, they were drug kingpins is what they were supposed to have been. And it turned out that they were no such thing. I mean, I knew that immediately. That was obvious. What I came to find out during the course of covering this, and there were a lot of other people working on this issue as well, is that they weren't even guilty of these minor drug offenses. This guy was making up stuff, that they were railroaded into prison. They essentially were convicted and sentenced in kangaroo courts.
So do we celebrate the fact that we have columnists who take up those causes, or do we bemoan the fact that we have a system that allows that to happen?
Oh, I just think that it's the Tulia thing. The frightening thing about the Tulia case is without the media spotlight, I'm absolutely convinced nothing would have happened. And those folks, some of whom got outrageous sentences, 30 years, 60 years, 90 years, would still be in prison.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Bob Herbert. He is often called the moral conscience of the op-ed page of the New York Times for his taking his skills as a journalist and his talent as an editorial writer and pulling them together and getting us to focus on one person's story as a way of trying to understand a bigger issue. Is that what you expect from your columnist? Does it get too political when you see it put in that way? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Bob Herbert worked as city editor of the Star-Ledger in Newark, New Jersey. He held a number of editorial positions at New York's Daily News, was a reporter for NBC, and has been working now for, what, about 12, 13 years as a columnist for The New York Times. His new book is called Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. He's here with me in the studio, and we're talking about his role as a columnist. We're going to go straight to the phones to Roxbury, Massachusetts. Mark's on the line. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, I'm thinking that I'm delighted that we have somebody like Bob Herbert who can help out in the print media. The problem that I see is that, number one, most people are starting to get their news not from print but from broadcast media, and number two, that these broadcast media are intrinsically concentrated and commercialized, and frankly, most of the reportage is done by people who don't do their homework and have no incentive to do their homework on serious matters.
And even the people who I see in television or on radio doing that kind of advocate work seem to, I don't know if you would agree with me, Mark, but seem to do it more for the show business side than they do for trying to get something resolved.
It's intrinsically an advertising-driven medium, and that's increasingly obvious as you watch it. I mean, there's no stomach for anything that would, and we as a society increasingly have less appetite for any serious discourse of any kind.
I mean,
this is not a left-right issue, or it shouldn't be a left-right issue. It's not politicization in the proper sense of the term. Rather, it's just a de-intellectualization and a dumbification of the American polity.
I agree strongly that it's not a left-right issue, and it should not be a political issue. The commercialization that has taken over most of the broadcast medium is also media. Has also affected to a great extent the print media. I mean, there's not a lot of papers out there like the New York Times. I mean, we're now getting the case of they're being concentrated under the umbrella of large corporations, and the bottom line is the primary issue, not the journalism. And you don't see, I mean, when I was much younger, there was an awful lot of crusading journalism that went on, and I'm a big fan of that sort of thing, probably not surprisingly. You don't see a lot of that anymore. So this is another direction that I think is not fortuitous.
Mark, you still there?
Yeah, I am. And I guess the question for Mr. Herbert, and I'm not sure there's an answer, but I'm very curious to hear his reflections on the thought, and I'm sure he's thought about it at greater length than I have, is how can we combat this trend? How can we reject, especially in broadcast media, how can we identify and try to have people reject casual and spuriously driven reportage, which doesn't even mention the two sides of an issue. You know, years ago it used to be that in order to demolish an opponent's argument, you first had to at least acknowledge that it existed. And this has disappeared. And I think we in part are responsible for letting it disappear. So we need to hold reporters, and I include television and radio reporters, to a higher standard. And we need to do it in a very public way. And how can we do that? And then how can we get people like Mr. Herbert, who I think have an ad hoc political position on the political spectrum, and how can we remove from them the stigma of being leftist just because they want to talk
about things? I'm not too worried about the stigmas at the moment, but I do think that we need to figure out a way to change this trend that you're talking about. And one of the ways, I mean, we need a lot more, but I think one of the places we might look would be the journalism schools. And the journalism schools, I think, need to emphasize this idea of what I think are the dangers of commercialization of news, and just kind of get it into the heads of the students as they're heading out there looking for jobs writing or on television or in radio. That the whole idea is that this is supposed to be a public service, that you're supposed to be providing information and a sense of depth about the issues that you're covering, and that this is a service to be provided to the consumers of your news. I guess consumers right there is a bad word. You should be, you know, your readers, your viewers, or your listeners. So I think the journalism schools would be a decent place to start.
I mean, the other part of what Mark's talking about, the way that opinions, ideas, and advocacy ends up being put into political boxes. I mean, you hear it all the time, I'm sure. We hear it in the sort of hurly-burly of opinions that are thrown around on a program like this, that the New York Times is left.
Right.
And therefore, everything that it writes about from a left-wing perspective, which, you know, people are welcome to draw that conclusion if they want, but if it allows them to then put it in a box and say it comes from a political agenda and it doesn't need to be taken seriously, it's like saying anything from the left or anything from the right is just part of theater, and it's not you know, looking at the issues in a substantive way.
Except the irony is that it's the media itself that bears so much of a responsibility for this. I mean, it's the media that not only tolerated this as it was in the process of being developed, but it's the media now that continues to push it. So it's your so-called news or news/opinion outlets that are promoting this thing as much as the politicians are promoting it. I mean, I think that what the job of the media, for example, would be when, let's say, a politician stood up and started making what I think are outrageous claims or whatever, the media is supposed to just stand up and say, well, just wait a minute, let's analyze this and let's see what's really so. And that's what we're getting away from. I hate these point-counterpoint shows on television where the person supposedly on the left screams at the person supposedly on the right, and, you know, vice versa. And you end up after half an hour of getting nothing. There's no enlightenment whatsoever.
That's what Mark was saying on de-intellectualization, I think. 1-800-423-8255 to Youngstown, Florida. And Glenn's joining us. Hi, Glenn.
Yeah, hello. Thank you, Mr. Gordon, for your show. It's definitely always good news that you bring, and
just
thank you.
Trying to keep you awake there, Glenn.
Yes, and thank you to your guest. I mean,
thanks so much.
Imagine the blessings those people would in Texas that are so grateful for your help, because otherwise, you know, how can you afford an attorney? How can you get anywhere? But my comment, and then my question is this. My comment is, it seems almost impossible to wrap your head around an idea that's this big, but I've kind of almost started to believe some of these conspiracy theories where the top 2% of not just the United States or whatever, but the top 2% of the people that run the world are consolidating that wealth and the power and the media, and the rest of us are seemingly getting on a treadmill and being used as cannon fodder in a war. And that's my comment, but my question, sir, is this, and that is, how is it that so many people, even people that are suffering with unemployment and poverty and such, can can seemingly be marching in jack step with some of these policies that are actually hurting them to the very core.
I think that as the decades go by, these big issues that you're talking about become ever more complicated, ever more difficult to understand. And actually, in the conclusion to my book, I talk about the extent to which people really don't grasp the issues that can have such profound effects on them and their families. And I think that this is a huge problem. I mean, you're absolutely right about the consolidation of wealth and power. You don't have to believe in conspiracy theories. I mean, you can just sort of look at the facts about that. And so the question is, how do people of ordinary or modest means, how do they counteract that, or how do they look out for their own interests? And they'll never be able to do that unless they become more knowledgeable about the issues that affect them. And obviously, the first place you start is education, but it becomes much broader than that. And that's sort of what I think should be one of the main topics of a national conversation. That's what I would like to see. How do you begin to erode what I think are the vast levels of ignorance among the ordinary population?
Something, I mean, you saw something change in the 1960s, and in your book you refer back to that time as a moment when there was a much higher level of engagement. I'm curious to know, in the conversations that you have with your readers, I know you get a lot of email. Mm-hmm. Are you in any way feeling that the seeds of that next generation that's going to do what you're talking about is out there? People are saying, no, we are going to make sure that we have a better
education
system.
I think that it might be out there, but I can't tell whether that's really true or whether that's wishful thinking on my part. But what I do know from the emails and the letters that we get is that there are so many people who, like your callers, are concerned about these issues and concerned about it in a very serious, very thoughtful way. One of the problems with the media, and probably with politics too, is that these folks, even though there's a lot of them, don't get a proper hearing. I mean, and so they're frustrated, and they feel that they can't affect the direction of the country. They can't affect the decisions being made by their government.
Are they right or are they wrong?
I think to a great extent they're correct. And so the question becomes, even if you have someone who wants to start something comparable to the movements that we saw several decades ago, how would they go about it, and how would anybody even know that it was happening? That's kind of a scary thought.
1-800-423-8255. Bob Herbert's here with me in the studio, and we're taking a call from Augusta, Georgia. Clem is on the line. Clem, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I was wondering, I want to ask Herbert what he thinks the logic is behind this kind of Republican push to decrease education, to decrease kind of NIH in a sort of act asking for a lack of sacrifice. I mean, what is the Republican reasoning? Do they think people are going to work harder by forcing us to, you know, by removing these benefits?
Well, Clem, let's start by asking him if Bob thinks it is a conscious push on behalf of the Republican.
Well, I think it's conscious push, but I think the basis for it is self-interest. I mean, the Republican leaders represent a segment of the population that benefit wonderfully from these policies. As to the question of whether they think people will work harder, I think the evidence is that people will work harder. I mean, Americans are among the hardest working people in the developed world now. It's the only way people have been able to maintain their standard of living. You know, now was a time when, you know, wives, to a great extent, did not work. Now it's common to have two-parent families where both parents are working. But also Americans put in tremendous number of hours. I mean, you know, so you have people working more. And then you have these attempts to change the government so that you don't have to pay overtime for extra hours worked. So, I think it's a conscious effort, but I think it's a conscious effort to take as many of the goodies on the table and bring them to your side of the table.
You wrote a column, and I can't remember how long ago it was, but it sticks in my mind when you were kind of marking the anniversary of the death of FDR. Is that?
Yeah, 60 years. This was just a few weeks ago.
That column
got a tremendous response, and it was FDR, and I believe it was his State of the Union address in 1944.
That's right.
where he enunciated his what he called the Second Bill of Rights. And this was a Bill of Rights where there would be guarantees that you would have essentially guaranteed shelter, that Americans would be guaranteed the right to an education, that you would be the business people would be guaranteed a workplace where they would be free from unfair competition and that sort of thing. And what I think is so strange is you look back at that. I have an assistant who's 30 years old and very smart, and when we were putting together the information for that column, she looked at it and she said, "My God, I can't believe a president would say that." It sounded to her like the most radical notion in the world. But the thing that struck me was that in the post-World War II era, we had the resources to begin doing the things that Roosevelt had proposed. And we would, if we had stayed with it, we would have come a long way to realizing his dream by now.
And yet when you pick apart those pieces that you listed from his State of the Union address, they're all, and I think you make the point in the column, they're all sort of, well, that's socialist, that's ridiculous, that's not going to happen. That's why your assistant would say
she couldn't believe
that these would be words uttered by a president.
She's astonished. And, you know, and that's another way. You know, language gets so corrupted. So, I mean, you could no more use the word socialism in sort of like ordinary discourse in this country. And if you, communism, I mean, you might as well, you know, jump into the river.
Well, liberalism's
like
been
that.
Put into this.
Exactly. But it all comes down to this idea in the United States, of course, it would be in a capitalist society, a capitalist democracy. It all comes down to the idea of a collective effort within the confines of capitalism to see that as many people as possible could do as well as possible, or at least to establish a floor beneath which you would not fall. You should not have, in a country as wealthy as the United States, people who are homeless.
Period.
Period.
1-800-423-8255. Davenport, Iowa. And or Indiana. Excuse me. It's Jack with us. Hi, Jack. Is it?
Hello.
Yeah, you're in Iowa. I'm sorry. I'm
Davenport, Iowa.
And I'm glad to have you with me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to say to Bob Herbert, I enjoy your columns very much. And
thank you for
your work that you've done over the years.
I really appreciate that.
I wanted to just comment a little further on you know, the comment you made, how American workers are smart, dedicated, and some of the most intelligent workers in the world. For example, if you just take the automobile industry, you know, what's been going on the last, you know, Dick Gordon, he had the fellow from GM and I believe it was Phillips Oil last week or whatever.
Yeah, we were doing a series on addicted to oil.
Mm-hmm. Well, between those two guys, it's absolutely pathetic because we are not taking advantage of really the most dedicated, most intelligent, technically innovative, you know, one of the best workforces in the world.
Right. That's exactly right. And we're going to find as we go farther into the future that because the workplace is becoming more complex, technology is ever more important, that you're going to need a better educated and a more well-trained workforce. But I don't think that we're taking the steps to do that now. But to go back to another aspect of this, and this is the idea of looking out for workers. As I came through my career, I started at the Star Ledger, which was not a union shop, but I was grateful for the opportunity to be able to break, believe me, I was grateful to break into the business. But then I went to the Daily News where they had a guild, so it was the first time that I was in a union. The difference in pay was dramatic, and everybody in the newspaper business in New York was unionized. It made a tremendous difference in the lives of now generations going forward, because you're talking about 3 decades or so here. I don't see how the United States was made worse off by the fact that there were union guarantees and protections for the workers over that period of time. And yet now, if you start talking about unions, once again, you'll get that little liberal bugaboo up there. And so the whole idea is to see if we can exploit the workers more and more. And that's just one more dangerous trend.
Connection listeners, can you do that? Can you have an intelligent, open conversation about you know, healthcare, the unionization of a certain workplace, without it completely becoming a shouting match over left or right or right or wrong. Can you have that kind of intellectual conversation? How much do we depend on our editorial writers to encourage us to have that conversation? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is Bob Herbert. His new book is called Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. The telephone number to join my conversation this hour with Bob Herbert, columnist for The New York Times, is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. I noticed that a couple of times when you leave the office, you go specifically to talk to young people to find out what they're thinking, what they're saying. A couple of years ago, you did this on a trip to Chicago.
Chicago, right.
Yeah. And that had quite an effect on you.
It did. You know, when I was a teenager, I guess I wasn't the brightest bulb in the world. You know, it was cars and rock and roll and girls and that sort
Who
of thing.
Who wasn't but cars it, and rock and roll?
Exactly.
That wasn't a measure of intelligence.
But I had all kinds of dreams. I thought my life was going to be a terrific life, and I had a lot of energy, and I was going after it. When I went out to Chicago and I was doing some stuff on unemployment, I started talking to these kids who are out of work and also out of school. They had dropped out of high school, but they weren't able to find jobs.
So how old are these kids, Bob?
These kids would range in age, I guess, from 15, 16 years old up. And so we go beyond high school age. You would have kids who are like 22 or 23. They had maxed out in terms of high school, but they still weren't working. So they had nothing going for them. There are 5.5 million kids like this in the United States. They're not even counted in the unemployment statistics. You know, they're
not in school, just not working, just hanging out at the mall.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way I referred to them in the column was out of work, out of school, and out of hope. And one of the things that struck me, and this is why I talked about what it was like when I was a teenager, my friends and I were all upbeat and had these dreams. I talked to these kids, and they were just... There was a lack of affect on their faces. You know, they didn't have dreams. They didn't talk in ordinary conversation about the things that they were planning to do. They had given up the idea that they'd be able to get a decent job or even any kind of job at all. With no money, you don't think in terms of marrying your sweetheart and raising a family and that sort of thing. And it was just, I thought, the saddest things in the world that these kids had no dreams to tell a reporter who was there interviewing them.
And when they talk to you, do they look at you and they say, hey, I could be who you are. I could be what you are.
No, they think that, you know, I would be something alien, a reporter from the New York Times. You know, if they looked at you and in your program, that would seem to them to be something so removed that it was almost a fantasy or something that they might see in a movie. It would be fiction. They think of real life as their lives out there on the streets where they don't know really where the next meal is coming from. So I say, well, what do you do? How do you eat? And inevitably, the answer is hustle, which could mean a million different things. You know, they steal things. They sell drugs when they can. And those are boys and girls. In some cases, the girls get into prostitution. And in some cases, they get into just, other incredibly horrible stuff. It's a sad story. It's another one of the stories that's below the radar as far as the media is concerned. I think most people just don't think about these kids ever.
How much of it has to do with race, though, when you're talking to the kids in whether it's New York or Chicago? Is this something that's particularly hard on the Latino kids, on the African-American kids? Something that where they're up against a whole lot more?
It is particularly hard on the black and the Latino kids. I think to some degree it has to do with race. I think that if these were white kids, I think that there would be more of a national response to their plight. But the issues are extremely complex. It's hard to narrow it down to something as simple as even just jobs or race or whatever. There's a whole wave of problems that some of them cultural, some of them economic, some of them racial, that need to be addressed in a serious, systematic way, and resources have to be applied. And there's no sentiment to do that in this country right now. So I'm not optimistic. It's one of the reasons why all across the country, including in suburban and rural areas now, gangs are beginning to get such a stranglehold on these kids because it's a place for the kids to turn where they feel they have no place else to go.
And we know what to do about gangs. You just put them all in prison.
There you go.
1-800-423-TALK to Spokane, Washington, and Paul's on the line. Hey, Paul.
Good morning. I run a teen center for teenagers in a low-income area in town, so I have two comments on Mr. Herbert's comments. We get a lot of black kids that come into the teen center. About 40% of the kids that come in there are black. There's some marvelous young black kids that have come in. They're good parenting, and they're doing well in school, and they're planning to go to college. But there's also about half of the kids, that black kids that come in, just have this chip on their shoulder. You can't even get a hello out of them. Some of the kids that you see that when they come in at 12 and 13, you know, they're in school and have a good attitude, but then you start seeing them hanging around with the wrong kids and you see their dress change, and pretty soon they're dropping out of school.
Are they there of their own free will, Paul? They are, right?
Yeah, totally. They come in and play basketball and that kind of stuff. And you just see a lot of waste in black kids on because of the sense of victimization. And you talk to them about school, and you get a comment back saying, "Well, you know, that's only a good deal for a white man. That's not good for a white man." And somewhere they're getting an attitude within their own community that they don't have a chance. But at the same time, I graduated from high school in 1959. At that time, 5% of white male high school graduates finished college, and you can't imagine how small a number that was for black male high school graduates. Well, now the numbers are dramatically changed. About 55% of white male graduates finish college now. Now it's nearly 30% for black male high school graduates finish college, and it's even higher for black female graduates. And so there's a, and I don't know, I sent an email back to Bob Herbert after that, his editorial on Roosevelt's State of the Union speech in 1944, and I recommended Mr. Herbert spend a day checking out the census data, and I think you'll find that in 1950, in the census data, nearly one half of the population in the United States lived below the poverty level. Now it runs between 12% and 15%.
You're saying that I make a strong point.
Roosevelt would be dramatically impressed with how this country.
Yeah, I make a strong point in the book, in whenever I'm talking, that I am not trying to say, because I was referring to the 50s and 60s in the book, that I am not trying to say that things were better then. I emphasize that things are much better now. But to get to your issue about the kids that are coming into your center, I mean, I don't know those kids specifically. But I did mention that in addition to economic matters, matters of education, that there are some cultural issues that are out there. And I've run into black kids myself who have disdain for studying and decide, you know, that that's a white kid's game. And that's a very serious problem. But that's not the overwhelming problem. I mean, for example, when I was out in Chicago and you talk to these kids who are out there on the street, most of them that I talked to had spent a great deal of time, and I had checked this out with the experts in Chicago, experts in education and in employment, desperately trying to get jobs. And we're talking about minimum wage jobs, McDonald's or any place else. They just can't get them. They've been unable to get hired. And if you're out there on the street hustling for a long period of time, I got to tell you, if it was me, I might be bitter too. I might have a chip on my shoulder myself. I'm not saying that the chip is necessarily helpful, but I think that it's kind of understandable.
Part of what Paul appears to be saying, though, is that when you run the numbers on the country, you see a much higher percentage of these kids that we're talking about who are finishing high school and are going to college. Does that make the 5.5 million that we're talking about any more of a something?
You don't want to make the comparison between now and then. You want to make the comparison between now and what the cultural norms are for the rest of the people in the population now. So what you need to do, if you're going to compare dropout rates or graduation rates with black kids, for example, then you compare those rates with the population as a whole in the United States, and they're dismal, and they're getting worse because with the No Child Left Behind law out there. The effort now is to push in many school systems to push these kids out of school in an effort to keep the school's test scores up, because the kids may not be doing well, you know, when they're taking these standardized tests. So they just let them drop out. There's no incentive to keep the kids in and keep them trying to learn, because if their scores are low, it brings down the overall rates for the school.
I'm just wondering, as I listen, if you can see these kinds of problems as the kinds of problems that can be fixed, because what you're talking about is a deterioration in the quality of life for people that goes back over decades. We're not just talking about
right.
this administration. We're talking about the previous administration and before that.
I think they can be fixed. I don't think they can be fixed entirely by government. I don't think that for a moment. What I think are that government policies are worsening the problem. So I think we need to stop that. We don't need the government worsening the problem. But I do think we need some cultural changes. I think we need stronger leadership in the black community. I mean, when I was growing up, you had black leaders that were on top of so many of these issues, whereas I think that that is not the case now. And I also think that there are some aspects of the urban culture that I just think have gone haywire. I mean, when you start talking about gangster rap and what I mentioned about the idea that doing well in school is a white kid's game, those are kind of things that need to be counteracted by the community itself, and I don't see the leadership there that I would like to see. But I think that this is all happening under a broader handicap of a lack of employment opportunities, a lack of good schools in the big cities, and an unwillingness to spend the money necessary to bring these schools up to speed.
1-800-423-8255. We're going next to Louisiana. Ricky's on the line. Hi, Ricky.
Hello, fellas. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Good. I listen to your program every day. And so many times I hear a program, every time there's something wrong within the communities, it always becomes, and please let me finish saying before you cut me off, it always becomes a race issue. If this, the comment that your guest made just a little while ago, if this would be white kids, they would take more of an interest in taking care of the problem than his black kids. Number one, I'm in here, I'm a working man, and I'm in this community, in the neighborhoods, in the towns and cities every day. Number one, it starts with discipline from the parents. I'm going to give you, for instance, in the school system that my kids are in. Most of the kids that are not disciplined, some black, some white, is because they have no respect for their parents, they have no respect for their teachers, and the kids who don't make it, some black and some white, is because they don't want to.
How do you teach that, Ricky? How do you change that?
It starts with the parents. First of all, discipline. I'm going to tell you another thing.
But let me interrupt just 1 second. You can keep talking. But I think, if you heard me correctly, I think you heard me say that I didn't think that it was just a race issue, that I thought that race was part of an array of issues there.
Yes, you did say that. But I also heard you say that if it would be white kids.
Right, I did say that. That's right.
That's right. That's what I'm talking about. This is not a race issue. Okay, because black kids have just as much, if not more, of an opportunity to have an education than white kids.
I disagree with that strongly.
No, sir, it's very so, because I'm going to give you an example. If I have a 17-year-old white son, which I do, who's graduating, and a 17-year-old black kid that parents makes just as much or maybe a little less money than I make, he is going to get more help from the government to go to college than my child will because he's white. But I'm not going to stand there and complain. I'm going to do something.
If you in fact believe that white kids have a better opportunity of getting a decent education in the United States in 2000,
he's saying black kids have a better.
I'm sorry, the black kids have a better opportunity of getting a decent education in 2005 in the U.S. than white kids, then you and I are going to just have to agree to disagree, because I disagree with that strongly.
I'm interested in knowing, from your perspective, a little preface here. Mm-hmm. I went back to 1993 when you were hired to do mm-hmm. your writing at the New York Times. There was a comment made at the time, oh, we're going to have the first African-American columnist at the New York Times, and we're going to get, you know, issues of race addressed. And you said, no, this is not what I'm here to do. I'm a reporter. I'm here to work on stories. But
it wasn't the Times that said that.
No, it was. You're right. You're quite right. It was. It was somebody writing about your appointment.
Right.
But I'm just wondering if your own opinion about that has changed. If people need to speak out on issues of race in ways that they aren't. It seems to me, in 99 and 2000, that this was a part of the American conversation, which kind of got pushed off the front page by 9/11 and hasn't come back since.
Right. My opinion, my view on that has never changed the whole time that I've been a reporter. And that is, I think the media should write about issues of race, and I certainly am willing to write about issues of race when they are significant stories, when they are important issues that need to be covered, that need to be explored. What my argument was whenever that issue came up is that because I'm a black columnist, that I would not be like the designated black story writer at any publication that I was at. But you're right that post-September 11, that those issues have really been pushed aside to a great degree. Now, to some extent, I just think that that's inevitable. I mean, I write two columns a week. To the extent that I'm spending a lot of time on the Iraq War or on troops or on torture issues and that sort of thing, then it leaves domestic issues, including domestic issues that have a racial component, off to the side. I mean, so I've got a stack of files of issues that I'd love to be writing columns about that I just haven't been able to get to lately. But now we're reaching sort of a dangerous state in terms of the media and the government, in which a lot of these issues are just completely out of sight, out of mind. So these kids that I'm talking about in Chicago, for example, nobody's addressing that terrain at all, and that's bad.
I'm wondering if in the communication you have with readers through email and through letters, though, at the end of a week you're left depressed or inspired by the fact that there are people who are out there working on these issues.
You can't get depressed. You know, I go home and, well, you watch sports, but then since I'm a Yankee fan, Boston got me depressed last year. If you're a reporter, you're always covering hideous issues, and you have to try and keep a sense of perspective, and you got to try and be optimistic.
And are there people who you write about and people who write you, who give you that sense of optimism, that there are people who you know, share this sense that things need to change and that they're willing to
put
their shoulder
to that
wheel.
There are people who write to me, but if you notice, lately there have not been a lot of people that I've been writing about that give me a sense of optimism. I think the government is in affairs in the United States right now are in a sort of pessimistic state, or in a state that warrants pessimism, I'll put it that way. But I think you can turn it around.
I thank you for coming in. It's great
Thanks
having you on the
very much.
Program. Bob Herbert, op-ed columnist for the New York Times. His new book is called Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream. Our program is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Help this week from Patrick Kiker. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.